This is CICK News. What does truth and reconciliation look like to you? Now recognized as a National Day of Remembrance, September 30th has become a day to learn and to listen. I joined a procession of people in Whitsett to learn about the community's response to the drug overdose epidemic that has taken 54 lives in 7 years in the community. This is the voice of Community Councillor Warner Nazelle on a chilly but bright day on Tuesday.
So what we plan on doing today is we have a march that we're going to do through the community. We're going to start here, work our way up. The subdivision is Joyce and Jamie's place. We'll stop in the corner there. We'll do a prayer circle and maybe some songs. We'll go in front of the apartment buildings. We're going to do a prayer there as well. And we're going to ask Doug and Sherry to lead the prayers. We're going to have drummers here. We're then going to move over to Laura's house where Warren passed away. And we're going to erect a cross there. His family is carrying the cross. They'll carry the cross to that site. We're going to erect the cross, set it up there. We'll do a prayer and words of support for the family who were left behind.
On September 30th, a gathering of nearly 100 people marched together to bring awareness to the effects of colonization on the generations following residential school survivors and family members.
Because a lot of people were hurt and damaged by drug abuse in the last 10 years in a whole neighborhood. So we're going to offer prayers for people in that neighborhood to heal from that. Because often, one of the big things that we struggle with in our community is paralysis. Paralysis from trauma. When we lose somebody from drug abuse, we almost don't know what to do. We're in shock. So this march today is to shake that shock off so we're not standing there in shock all the time because of the losses that we've experienced. We want to begin doing something. We can't stand here and be in shock our whole life. At some point, we have to get moving. We have to pray. We have to do activities to help the healing happen in our community. All of our families have struggled too long. Many of us, the people who passed away through the community, we're going to recognize them and we're going to offer healing to everybody who struggles with this.
Warner Nazelle led the march and with a committee organized the sites that we would visit. The people walking and driving were elders, community counselors, chiefs, families who have lost loved ones to overdose or to drug-related deaths, children, aunties, uncles, and neighbors.
One of the reasons why we picked today to do the walk to address the drug crisis on Truth and Reconciliation Day is because I'm a frontline worker. I work in Hazleton, and I help a lot of people who are struggling with drug abuse and alcohol abuse. And every time I talk with my clients, I try and get to the root of the problem. Where did it all start? And often they'll talk about traumas that they've experienced in their life. Could be like really heavy traumas. They've experienced that in their lives. And the people who caused that trauma on them, I ask them to name them. And then ask them, where did they get that trauma from? Because it's not something that comes natural. They have to mention the next person that's in line. They said, oh, I had a grandpa or I had a great uncle who was really mean all the time. And he used to do stuff. My family always talked about it. Okay, where do you think he got it from? And it always goes back to any residential schools. Everybody who suffers from trauma in their communities, from drug abuse, the other kinds of trauma that we all know about, that all started from Indian residential schools. So we connected the two dots. The drug crisis that we're struggling with here today is as a result of what happened to our children in Indian residential schools. Some of those children survived and they brought back trauma. They brought back trauma that they learned. And they passed it down generation to generation. And that trauma is still very much alive in our community. So what we want to do is shine a light on a dark space, on a shadow that sits right over top of our community. We want to shine a bright light on that and expose it for what it is and learn to heal from it. So this is one of the big first steps that we want to do to address that. So I want to again thank everybody for coming out and joining on us and giving yourself an opportunity to heal, because we're all going to have an opportunity to heal today. Thank you.
Though the seriousness of the day was prevalent in the moments where we stopped and listened, children continued to play, and people held each other in acts of love and support. People would come out of their houses to wave and smile at us as we walked by, and the feeling of how close the community of Whitsett is what permeated the day. We walked through the streets of Whitsett in awareness, and as Chief Elgin, Pastor Doug, Sherry Warner, and other speakers professed, this is for the future of Whitsett's children. That is the sound of a metal cross being hammered by many people into the ground where Warren Morris died on the front lawn of his aunt's house last year. He was 35 years old. Family was encircled by the community to mourn and hopefully to begin healing together.
Love you, Warren.
Wish for Ruby in the family.
So the objective for this cross is for families to have a place to come and pray. You can work on making necklaces, you can come up with flowers, whatever it is you want. You can plant a little garden around it, but it's a place for the community, the neighborhood here, the family have a chance to come and let things go. We heard some of the family cry earlier when we got here, and it's so important. We have to heal from this. If that healing requires us to cry, if it requires us to talk about really hard things, then that's what we should be doing to heal. So this place is the first one that we're recognizing now. We want to do many marches in the future to recognize other places, because a lot of people pass away in this community from drug abuse and the drug crisis and their addiction. And we want to recognize them as well. So Warren is one of the freshest memories that we have. A lot of people are impacted by his loss. I'm impacted by his loss. I was really good friends with his late dad. So I think it's such an important thing to have a place where we can come and pray, where we can offer prayers, to comfort Laura, because her nephew passed away in her yard. He was on his way home to see his mom, and he only made it this far. So it's a place where we can offer prayers for the whole family. There's a lot of people that Warren left behind. His good friends. He has so many good friends. We're all left behind. So it's a place, I think it's important to recognize the fact that we have a beautiful opportunity to just offer prayers now. Come by and drop some flowers off. Even just come by and lay some medicine down or some tobacco down. And just say a few words for the family. The energy that comes from prayers is powerful. A lot of us know just how powerful that is. It's incredibly powerful. So if we can do that for the family and come here and offer prayers once in a while, even if you're coming back from a walk or coming back for a ride, pull over. Come over and just offer prayers. Say some prayers for the neighborhood. There's lots of kids that live here. Let's pray for their safety. Let's pray for the elders who are left behind, puzzled, because We're not supposed to be burying our young. But here we are.
Masai to Warner Nizel, Matt Anderson, the families of Warren Morris and Draper Poirier, and to Charmaine Nicol for making this recording possible. And Masai to the community of Wetset for doing the work to face the challenges in their community and ensuring a safe and healthy future for their next generation. Today on CICK News, Jolene Swain, a farmer from the Kispiox Valley, discusses the significant changes proposed to Canada's breeders' rights system. With a background in biology and over a decade of farming experience, Swain highlights the implications of these changes, especially the shift of seed saving from a right to a privilege. We'll speak about the financial impact on farmers due to increased royalties on seeds, even when reused, and the role of large agrochemical companies in driving these changes.
My name is Jolene Swain, and I am a farmer up in the Kispiox Valley on Gitxsan territory. We grow vegetables and grains and livestock and also seed crops for some small seed companies, including the BC Eco Seed Co-op. Yeah, I've been here for 10 years, and my background is in biology. So initially working with diversity and wetlands, and I just was drawn towards food systems, which led me into seeds.
Could we start talking a little bit about these changes that are being proposed to Canada's plant breeders' rights system?
There's been a lot of kind of a wide feedback period. I don't know the legislation in and out. I've been following along, hearing about some of these breeder rights, and the UPOV 91 that I think you're referring to was legislation that was passed actually in 2015. And so what already happened with that was that we lost a lot of the rights to save seed. And instead of the right to save seed being a right, it became more of a privilege. And so the current changes are further degrading that by basically putting more royalties on seed, even if you save it yourself. So when you initially buy seed, you might pay some royalties, or if it's a plant breeder right protected variety, which it's important to value research, and royalties are a great way of doing that. But what this does is it extends that royalty period. So every time you buy or even sell seed, you might be paying royalties on it. And I don't know if farmers can really afford more cost to their seed system. And I don't think we should be taking away the right to save seeds or making it more difficult.
Can you give me some examples of plants that you mentioned that have plant breed royalties on them already?
It's more to do with varieties that are registered, from my understanding. So this is really a lot more common at the commodity scale. So this is when we're talking about wheats or pulses, or in the US, this would be like corn and soy and beets, and certain varieties that are registered in order to grow like wheat and sell it to the wheat, and what was previously the wheat board, but into the Canada wheat pool, it has to be a registered variety. You can't just find any heirloom seed, source any seed you like. It has to be one of the registered varieties. So this applies more at that larger scale. You do see it a little bit at vegetables. Like there's a database on the CFI website. I could find a link for that where they list which varieties might have plant breeder rights attached to them. And those would often be things like hybrids and whatnot.
The government is proposing new legislation that involves genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. However, the relationship of GMOs to this legislation is not entirely clear at this moment. The Canadian Food Inspection Agency, or CFIA, mentions that the changes are intended to bring about innovation, but there's skepticism, particularly from organizations like the National Farmers Union, or NFU, about whether this will merely result in increased costs for farmers. The real beneficiaries of these legislative changes appear to be large agrochemical seed companies, and these companies are heavily involved in lobbying for the new rules that could result in more royalties for them. But the question remains, are these changes genuinely meant to serve the interests of innovation, or do they primarily cater to big business interests? This raises broader questions about the role of lobbyists and governmental agencies like the CFIA. How do these entities balance the interests of the public and private companies? And what does this mean for farmers who rely on fair practices to maintain their livelihoods? As these changes unfold, it's important for our community to stay informed and engaged in discussions about the impact on agriculture and economy. Now, let's continue my conversation with biologist Jolene Swain.
I think it's important to acknowledge plant breeders and that they should be compensated for the work they're doing, but I also think that the government should be funding public research that's farmer-led and whether it's public institutions like universities or on the ground, even nonprofits doing the work as opposed to these private seed companies. And I also think that the government should be encouraging farmers to save seed on their farm. And with this legislation does the opposite. And by saying that it's like it's innovation and modernizing our seed, it doesn't quite fit. Like, humans have been working with seeds for millennia, and by making it more difficult for them to do that doesn't bode well for our seed and food systems.
Yeah. And I guess pivoting from that, what is the significance of seeds to people's food sovereignty, culture, survival? And I guess, how is this amendment to the Plant Breeders Act that's proposed by the CFIA, how is that threatening things such as food sovereignty, culture, and survival?
Yeah, it's just that degradation of the right to save seeds doesn't bode well. We can't have food sovereignty if there isn't seed sovereignty, and seed saving shouldn't be something that ever feels wrong or illegal. As I was saying, seed saving goes back millennia. We've been saving, selecting, breeding for thousands of years, and modern breeding is built on that work. So we're not acknowledging that with this either. It's more corporate control of our seed system, which makes it even harder to have a more food sovereign system.
The Buckley Valley Farmers Market or something like that. Are they legally allowed to save seeds from their plants?
Yeah, for the most part, I feel like the small scale vegetable, it just mostly flies under the radar of this legislation. The thing I'd hate to see is for it to be like illegal, but do it anyways. That's for most vegetable varieties. If they're open pollinated, you're okay. One of the issues though, is that a lot of our seeds, we've lost the diversity of varieties. If you look in a seed catalog and you want to buy cabbage nowadays, you might find one or two open pollinated cabbage that you could save the seed from, and that seed would be true to that variety.
Open pollination occurs when plants are naturally pollinated by insects, birds, wind, or human hands without human intervention in selecting parent plants. This process ensures genetic diversity that can lead to stronger and more resilient plant varieties. One of the main benefits of open pollination is the preservation of genetic diversity. This diversity is crucial for adapting to changing environments and combating diseases. Open pollinated plants also tend to be more robust and better suited for organic farming. Unlike hybrid pollination, which involves controlled pollination to produce specific traits, open pollination maintains a plant's natural breeding process.
But most of the varieties in the catalog are going to be hybrids. And hybrids, when you save their seed, that's going to be a very diverse offspring. And this legislation actually removes the right to even save hybrid seed. Not that many people do, because but it is still breeding material that's out there. So not only do we lose more diversity in our food system, we lose more materials to continue breeding at the small scale, like vegetable growers. And vegetable growers are probably the best people to be saving seeds on their farm, because they could locally adapt their varieties they're growing for their region.
Canada's Plant Breeders' Rights, or PBR Act, grants breeders exclusive control over new plant varieties for 20 years, but includes a farmer's privilege clause allowing farmers to save and reuse seed from their own harvest. These proposed CFIA amendments would remove this privilege for fruit, vegetable, ornamental, and hybrid crops, requiring farmers to buy new seed annually and pay royalties. Critics argue that this could raise production costs, limit access to new varieties, hinder climate adaptation, and erode long-standing seed-saving practices. They call instead for stronger public plant breeding investment, stressing that farmers' privilege is essential for food security and Canada's sovereignty.
I think it's important that people are paying attention to these changes. Otherwise, they can go under the radar. And even though we may not see the impact directly at first, it really sets a bad precedent.
Thank you to Jolene Swain for giving context on the implications of new seed legislation and the importance of seed sovereignty. This highlights concerns over these restrictive laws, such as UPOV 91, which limits farmers' rights to save and use seeds, potentially increasing cost and limiting diversity in crops. This conversation really emphasized the need for a living seed bank and the value of open pollinated seeds over controlled hybrids. This conversation also highlighted the significance of community-level seed saving and the potential economic impacts on our listeners. Author Tracy Skuse has been in the Bulkley Valley for 2 weeks for a writer's residency through the Smithers Public Library. I sat down with Tracy to discuss how the Valley could inform some new writing of hers, a workshop she held, and an invitation to join Tracy tonight at the library in Smithers for a book reading.
Hi, I'm Tracy Skuse, and I am here from Vancouver Island. I'm a writer, and I got the honor of being the first writer in residence of Smithers of the Bulkley Valley. So pretty excited to be here.
Can you talk a little bit about what your connection is with the Bulkley Valley?
Sure. Yeah, my sister Nikki has lived here since the early 2000s. And so she's my connection. I think I came up here like 25 years ago for the first time. And I don't know how I end up here mostly in the winter. I think I've been here in the summer like once, and I'm like, I'm never going to Smithers again in the winter. It's so cold. Like one year it was minus 38 or something at Christmas, and I'm like, no, that is too cold. But it's really beautiful to be here in a temperate season. The island has softened me for those winters. Yeah.
Do you know what you're going to be working on when you're here?
I have a couple of short stories. So I have a collection of short stories called Atmospheric River that I'm working on. And it's sort of rooted in relationships that are falling apart during climate. But like when I started that idea, so it sort of morphed a little bit, and I'm working with the same ideas, but using ideas of like, or animism of like kind of how more relational to the land that we are living on, and how that can actually help us in this moment of climate crisis.
Are your places kind of characters as well then, or is it still human-centered in place?
Actually, the story Atmospheric River is, stayed really out of the consciousness of the characters and wanted to try and write it that way. I love playing with point of view. And so there was one point that I was like, this story needs to break open, but the characters are kind of like rigid in their positions. So I gave the story over to the forest, and the forest kind of narrated their relationship from the past. So like it held the memory. They weren't willing to go there, so I let the land take it over.
I know, I'm trying to think like what almost like characteristic or like kind of like natural like object I would think has like the loudest voice. I guess it would probably be the mountain here, actually, just because it's always there.
Yeah. I keep just walking downtown and then turning around and I'm like, oh my God, you are so formidable, these mountains. And I've been here before, and that is one of those things that I kind of forget and then see. I'm like, oh my God, you are amazing. Mm-hmm. And and the river, we went to the river yesterday, and I live near a river and I love rivers. And yeah. I think a lot of times when we think about story, we think about what happened, right? And that is important, but then the emphasis tends to go on the action. But what really we need to learn about in story is how that event, however quiet, impacts the life of the character. So I find that just like getting people to think about what questions are you asking, are you curious about? You don't even have to answer the question in the story, but it's like perhaps helping your story move forward, because you're continually turning over that question. So a very basic question is like, who am I? Or who is this character, right? And we're continuing to like unpack it and wonder, instead of thinking that you already know the answer, because what kills a story faster as a writer is if you think you already know. It just like deadens the story pretty immediately on the page.
Is there anything else that kind of you're finding now that you're in this place? Like, are you kind of gathering any sort of feelings, or do you know kind of how you want to spend your time best?
I want to do a lot of like deep listening so that I can move my stories from that place. So this just gives me an opportunity to like, oh yeah, that's a good... Anyway, we'll see how that goes. That could change tomorrow.
Well, very excited to find out.
Yeah, yeah, I'll let you know.
Tracy Skuse is at the Smithers Public Library tonight for a reading from her book, Hunger Moon, at 7 p.m. All are welcome. CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening.